So welcome everyone. This is our final colloquium of the semester. I guess that means a year. But it's also a special one for some of us, and I recognize since it was 7 years ago when Arlen left us, most of the people in this room didn't know Arlen personally, but those of us who did found him a pillar of our department, and most importantly, one of the most stimulating people one could talk to about science, because he never cleaved to the common wisdom. My favorite story about this is he received the Pierce Prize from the American Astronomical Society as the most distinguished observational astronomer under the age of 35, and it was for his really elegant work on the light echoes from supernova 1987A. So everyone assumed when he got up to give his address, the AAS, that he'd be talking about light echoes from 1987A. And I was sitting next to a very prominent astronomer whose name shall remain my secret for a while. Arlen launched into his project to measure the shape of the halo of M31 using microlensing. And about 3 minutes in, this prominent astronomer leader, he said, "What the hell is he doing?" And I said, "Well, he's done the light echoes, now he's doing something new." And that was very characteristic, not to mention his elegant work about the moon, which then was considered so radical it couldn't be published, now in fact is accepted wisdom. So it's a special event for those of us who know Arlen, and we're going to continue this forever. We have an endowment for it to remember his name even when no one left. No one is left here, actually. Many people here work with Arlen or talk with Arlen, but one of the ones whose office was across the hall from Arlen is Zavi. He'd like to say a few words.
Yeah, so very quickly, so Arlen is a person I miss every week. Yeah, every week I have an idea. I want to discuss this with Arlen, and I can't. So that told me that whenever you can discuss something, do it while you can. And I remember talking to him the last night, and he was still sharing all his scientific ideas. I still have to cry because he couldn't do that. So that taught me that if you're right, you do it today, not wait until tomorrow. Every time I walk into his office with any idea, lightning on Jupiter or, repurposing telescopes to do something crazy, either he told me that it's really crazy and it was really crazy, or we wrote a paper. So please, whoever walks into your office, think about that idea. So, and remember Arlen, he was really unique. I'm very happy that I had a chance to meet him and work with
him. Yeah, I'll introduce our speaker. So obviously, in Arlen's honor, we named this lecture the Radical Hypothesis Lecture. And so we are very excited to have such a hypothesis being presented to us today. Dr. Daniel Lapai is joining us. He distinguished from the University of Arizona, but he began his career in Hungary with his undergraduate studies, and he performed his PhD at Heidelberg. He then moved to the US and has spent time at Stewart Observatory, the Space Telescope Science Institute, before starting his position at the University of Arizona. He's a joint position between astrophysics and planetary science. He works in many, many different topics, from astrobiology to exoplanet characterization to, as we're here today, work on more of the engineering aspects, instrumentation aspects. So, very excited to introduce Dan Pai today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I very much appreciated the opportunity to give this lecture. Of course, I was not lucky enough to know Arlen personally, but I know some of his work, and I think just through the literature, the published literature, the book that he wrote about the new moon and visioning human colonization of the moon, I think his originality, spirit, ideas really shine through even today. So I was very honored to come here and speak at this lecture series, and I wanted to thank you for the invitation. Today I want to tell you about what I hope we'll find radical enough. It is certainly a hypothesis enough. I will show you progress on an idea that we started to work on 7 years ago. And in the first 3 years, I didn't tell almost anyone about the idea because it looked a little bit too fringe, too far out there. And so I built a small team to pursue the idea. We identified some of the critical questions through modeling, through early prototypes, we were able to convince ourselves that this idea may just work. And so I'm ready over the past years and to share this idea with you. We have published many aspects of this. By now we have more than 20 papers on different aspects of this project. So it really moved from a project that you want to tell about to anyone to one that I'm excited to share today. So the general theme here is Nautilus Space Observatory. And as you see, the goal here that I will get to is characterizing 1,000 Earths and what it will take to do that. So if I wanted to phrase this as a hypothesis, a radical hypothesis, I would think that maybe this would capture it. By rethinking how we design and build space telescopes, we could vastly expand astrophysics, understand the diversity of habitable planets, and survey 1,000 Earths for signatures of life without really requiring a larger budget than we have today. Of course, that's an important practical consideration, maybe less exciting, but big ideas have to be confronted with practicality and ability to realize. So in this talk, I will touch on a broad range of topics. So if you ever get lost, I'm happy to take questions in the middle of the presentation too, or just speak later and clarify some of the ideas. But I will touch a little bit on signatures of life, of how we could search for potentially signatures of life on other planets. I will touch a little bit on how we design and build space telescopes, what is the current paradigm, and even more focusing on how we could change that or what are the limitations and what could be opportunities to change that. And then I will touch a little bit about really what is the idea here, the different approach that we believe is exciting and needs to be considered. And then I will touch finally on how we actually build a space telescope based on this technology that I will be describing and this approach, and how we can use that to survey 1,000 Earths. So let me just set, and I think many of you know this, but I wanted to make sure that nobody's completely lost already in the third slide. So I will just briefly introduce that we have now different methods through which we can characterize the atmospheres of planets or another star, extrasolar planets. These rely on spectroscopy. They rely on the fact that light that passes through the atmosphere or scattered by the atmosphere of a planet will carry the spectral fingerprints of molecules and atoms, absorbers, and particles that are in the atmosphere. Okay, what's the microphone? So these, the light that if we can capture it and we can analyze it in significant amounts, we will be able to infer, constrain the composition of atmospheres. Now, the practicality of how to do this is difficult. Fundamentally, there are two methods that are currently quite well known. Conceptually, one is to observe a system during a planetary transit. This is when the planet passes in front of its host star. And when it does so, the atmosphere will basically act as an absorption experiment, if you like. Light from the star will pass through, and molecules that are present in the atmosphere will be able to absorb light at the appropriate wavelengths. And so we can basically, by comparing the light before and after, conceptually simple experiment, a time-result experiment, we can measure this time differential and use the absorption spectrum of the atmosphere. The details are more complicated, but that's a fundamental idea. And this is really the way we have been able currently and over the past decade to characterize the atmospheres of increasingly small planets, moving from Hot Jupiters, gas giant planets, all the way towards Earth-sized planets. There is another, and I will return to this a little bit later, but for context, I wanted to show it. There's another exciting pathway, direct imaging and spectroscopy. This is a pass in which we are separating spatially the light of the star from the light of the planet. So this is a simulation how it that shows how the solar system could look like if observed through a powerful space telescope, a 16-meter diameter space telescope. And it uses a trick. You need an active starlight suppression system. to separate, to suppress the light of the star so that we can study the light of the planet. And so both of these techniques can provide us information about the properties of the planet. They provide similar but not identical information. None of this is complete, but they are all very useful. We can use them to characterize the planet.
You can just put it in your pocket because there's another mic on there. So it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
so, okay. So currently, the telescopes that are we have in space are using transmission spectroscopy and Big James Webb. We are very excited to, I think, see the first direct imaged exoplanets emerging from space. We have been doing direct exoplanet imaging from the ground too. James Webb and Hubble has been very successful in doing transmission spectroscopy. Looking forward, there are ambitious ideas to use directly direct imaging with a large telescope to survey nearby stars to look for planets. So what do we look for when we are looking for biosignatures? I think we would all wish that we would be able to detect advanced complex life and learn immediately everything about other civilizations that are on there. It's not going to happen unless we can detect technosignatures. More likely what we will be able to detect are global biospheres, ecosystems, that have successfully transformed their home planets. We are really looking at changed worlds, just like Earth was transformed fundamentally when life flourished. We hope that other worlds may undergo similar transformations. This figure here shows, and the details are not necessarily important, but it's a timeline. This was 4 billion years ago. This is present time. And these lines show here carbon dioxide, methane, and oxygen. And what the key point is that the Earth has underwent a major transformation when oxygenic photosynthesis, a very efficient way of creating energy, harvesting energy, became prevalent. It has changed the atmosphere. It has changed the redox state of the entire planet, including the upper lithosphere. So it has changed the color composition of the atmosphere, and this is the kind of signal that we would be able, hopefully, to detect if we have the right equipment. Currently, it is beyond reach. None of our telescopes can do it, but we hope that we can build facilities that will be able to do it. And I'd love to tell you more about this. I will try to keep this, not to go over too much into details here, but if anybody has questions, I'm really happy to tell more about the details. Now, we recently completed, of course, the ASTRO 2020 Decadal Survey, and the Decadal Survey identified, I think it was very exciting for the field of exoplanets. It identified that the search for habitable exoplanets and atmospheric biosignatures is a central science question for the next decade. It was very highly prioritized, and the Decadal Survey recommended that an approximately 6.5-meter diameter direct imaging mission would be built. And I put there a cost that's not the official cost, that's my estimate, but we are probably speaking here about $10, $11 billion. And it is recommended that there's a precursor technology maturation to a low, basically, the technology starlight suppression in particular to reach the right stage before we proceed with this project. So the goal here is to characterize about 25 habitable zone planets. So if you do the math, that translates with that price tag to roughly $400 million to maybe a $2 billion per planet, depending on how many planets you really end up with. So each target is precious, and we will have some information, but limited information about those. Now, our key point here is the occurrence rate of Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone. If they are more common, it will be, we will have a larger yield. If they are small, less common, it will have a smaller yield. Without going too much into details, what I want to point out is that direct imaging is exciting. It provides very important information, and I also use and have been using direct imaging techniques, but it also comes with a limitation. And that limitation is, of course, the details are more complex, but let me just point out that the effective resolution, angular resolution of a telescope will depend on its diameter. The larger the telescope, the greater the resolution that we can have. Formula, then, of course, at the same time, our target that we need to resolve, the star and the planet of the sky, they also have a characteristic distance scale. And that's, in the case of the Sun, it's one astronomical unit. And for many other planets, that are habitable, they will be at a similar distance from their host star. And the farther away, of course, we have to resolve that linear scale, the smaller angle that will correspond. Now, this, and none of this should come as a surprise. One part that's an empirical component here is that, unfortunately, larger telescopes cost more to build. In fact, they cost much more to build. And an approximate relationship built on past missions is that the cost can scale with the, roughly the second power of the diameter. So, 2 times larger telescope costs 4 times more. So, what this also means that if you combine them is that going farther, imaging habitable planets farther in space will also go roughly as a cost as a with a square of the distance. So going from 10 to 20 parsecs, from 20 parsecs to 40 parsecs, that will be always a big cost multiplier. Because our costs are limited, that basically means that direct imaging is a very efficient tool in the solar neighborhood, but it's not an efficient tool going typically beyond 40 parsecs. So one big question is how many targets do we have in 10 parsecs, 20 parsecs, or 40 parsecs? So let me bring in another angle here, search for life in the universe. And I mentioned that it is a highly ranked science goal, not just in astronomy, but in other sciences and also astrobiology. Now, it is not an easy task to go from a low-resolution spectrum, maybe 30, 40 points, and interpret it and determine and be confident that we have actually detected signatures of life. So what I will point out here is that there have been quite a few studies now exploring the complexity and diversity that we would expect from habitable planets. And if you think about what is the minimum information that you would need to correctly model the key processes on Earth, including an ecosystem, you can get a sense that it is not a simple problem. So we need information. And we are really probably going to work in a high-dimensional parameter space. The planet's size, composition, insulation, volatile content, the past history of the planet, the type of metabolism that's present if life is there, the climate cycles, these are all variables that we need to understand if we want to have a robust interpretation of what we are seeing. This is another figure that captures basically just many connections. And there may be some too small for you to see, but it does show that no planet, especially a habitable planet, can be studied well in isolation or just as a simplified system. Earth is a system of systems. So high-dimensional parameter space, where we need to identify trends, clusters, correlations, connections. What we need to do if we solve problems in high-dimensional space is data. We need many data points that span those dimensions so that we can constrain them. So what now you can start to see where issues combine. On one hand, our current plans, as exciting as they are, they will only allow us an exciting first look, but it will be a limited set of planets. On the other hand, we have a very complex problem in understanding these planets. Let me add to it a little bit more. I want to show 6 numbers of where we are. So it takes now typically about 30 years between the largest astronomy missions. That's a long time. So we just successfully launched James Webb. It's extremely exciting, but it was a long march to get here. Furthermore, for the next year, the next mission that's recommended will not have actually larger mirror diameter than what James Webb has. James Webb may be the largest telescope that we see in our lifetimes. The recommendation is a 6.5 meter telescope, which is the same size as Hubble, James Webb. It will be much higher in image quality to allow the starlight suppression, but it will not be a more sensitive telescope, but larger. So that's until 2050, that's the current trajectory. But what is also concerning is that James Webb was such a huge success, not, I mean, technically also, it's an amazing mission. And we were, everybody involved, that was not really actively involved, but we as a community managed to navigate around 344 single point failures. That means any one of these didn't go right, you would not have a mission. All of this went right, and that's an amazing achievement, a testament to the team, but it also came at a cost. This made the mission very expensive. There were no real redundancies for many of them, none of these. And you may think that, okay, if James Webb didn't work, we now know how to do it, we could build another one. That's not the case. Most of the facilities, the components, the expertise required to build James Webb are no longer there. We could not build another James Webb. So that's kind of can put you in an uncomfortable position, right? We spend maybe $10 billion on it, and there were risks. Risks are unavoidable, but looking forward, we are working in this more than 10-dimensional parameter space when we want to understand planets, habitable planets, and alien ecosystems. But right now, we are looking at maybe 25 planets, maybe fewer, that we will be able to study. So I think we have an exciting next step to take, but we should not stop there. We need to look at ways to do this on a larger scale. So I started in 2015, I formed a team, we started to think about how we could probe 1,000 exoars. And I think what you will see here is that much is happening in this current time, and that may open new opportunities. So this, of course, probably most of you recognize this. This is a new rocket system being built. This one's taken in Texas. This is SpaceX's Starship rocket. It is. Its intended purpose is to ferry people to Mars and back. And this is not functional yet fully, although they did have successful flights, mostly successful flights. But they are very close, and in the next weeks, we may actually see an actual orbital test flight. Of course, Artemis, NASA's Artemis, through the Space Launch System, is now orbiting the Moon, a very exciting development too. Both of these rockets enable much larger payloads to go to space. But Starship does more than that. So not only if it is working, and we'll still have to see that it's not a done deal, but if this becomes successful, it will be the largest rocket ever built, which also means the largest capability to bring cargo to space. But it is also important for two other reasons. One of them, very importantly, is the cost advantage that SpaceX hopes to reach with this rocket. What you see here are launch costs from 1960 until 2030. The last part is a projection, of course. What we see is basically in the first 40, 50 years of spaceflight, space launch, getting a kilogram mass to orbit was somewhere between $30,000 to $60,000, depending on whether you had a crew or no crew and which system you use. What happened here, you notice in around 2010, suddenly there is a significant drop. This is a logarithmic scale. So that significant drop is due to the SpaceX's reusable launch vehicles that allow us to now launch into space much much lower cost to the same mass. And we are currently here. If SpaceX manages to successfully fly Starship in the way they imagine they plan to, then they may reach $200 going from 60,000, okay? $200 or so per kilogram. Now, even if they don't reach 200, but they stop at 400, it is still a revolution, okay? In our capabilities to get the thing into space. It's a bit akin to, like, imagining, you know, you build a house, you have land in Manhattan, you build a house, you are not going to build a small house, you are going to build a high-rise skyscraper because the land is so precious. But if what happens is not suddenly you can build houses, in a suburb where maybe the land price is at 100 times lower, you will go to a different architecture. You will build different houses. You will rethink what makes sense. And this is where we are now. Now, the last third advantage here is that Starship, if it's working as it's envisioned, or even if it's just half as good, it will not have one launch a year, just like NASA's SLS system, but they plan a launch every week or so. Now, this may sound crazy, but SpaceX already outcompeted all other companies in the launch industry. They do more launches than all other companies combined, and they actually have pretty high cadence for the flight. So what does this tell us? So this brings us to basically this juncture in time that we see a technological revolution in launch vehicles, and we see grand challenges in astronomy and quantum sciences that need larger telescopes. It is the time to rethink how we build telescopes and change the paradigm. So what I think is important here is that innovations in optical technology now enable a new paradigm for space telescope, and practically this is achieved through scalable optical manufacturing. I'm going to explain what that means. So let me bring in Nautilus now. So we started Nautilus. That's basically really my interest here is not so much to lead a space mission or build a space telescope. My interest is to try to help contribute to solving a problem. That problem is to understand the diversity of Earth-sized planets, so we have a basis to search for signatures of life, correct me. So these are the goals of Nautilus, the Nautilus Space Observatory. And these are similar to some of the other missions, but the key difference is that our goal from the get-go is to characterize 1,000 planets. Not 10 or 12 or 3, but 1,000. And to do it that is in a way that is compatible with the NASA flagship mission, so that we are not, you know, we are consistent with in terms of what's found about. The way we want to do it is not to do direct imaging, although that's a fantastic technique for many science questions, and it may give us the first insights into the solar neighborhood planets, but it has a built-in sensitivity limitation in terms of the distance it can probe. So we want to actually use planetary transits. This is just, again, an animation that shows a planet passing in front of the star. The key point here is that I do not need spatial information to do these measurements. It's a temporal measurement where I measure the system before and during the transit, and I can take a temporal difference to characterize my planet. We can, and we have studied already planets that are more than a kiloparsecs away through planetary transits, and that's a distance that's unsinkable if you use direct imaging. So there is an advantage, an opportunity to extend reach larger samples if you use this technique. Can transmission spectroscopy actually probe the key absorbers and key components in habitable planets? The answer is yes. These are simulations using state-of-the-art simulations for Earth's atmosphere. I will not go through the details here, but as you would imagine, transmission spectroscopy works well. We can detect absorbers, oxygen also in water. You need two things for this to work. One is that your system has to be temporally stable because it's a temporal difference that you are measuring. And excitingly, the temporal stability aspect is already there. Kepler on the brightest stars is already reaching post-reduction the same kind of, within a factor of a few, the same precision that we need. So photometric stability is also there. What you need, the second thing, are photons. You need photons to do this measurement so that the photon noise is low. These measurements here, let me measure one more thing. So what I'm showing you here is sun-like stars on the top and low-mass stars, red dwarfs, and bottom as hot stars, always in our sun transiting. This is at 10 parsecs, 100 parsecs for the sun-like stars, it's 50 parsecs, 300 parsecs. These distances are taken as an example for what would be the farthest transiting planet that you would need to be able to study if you wanted to have a sample of 1,000. Okay. And I'm happy to tell you more about this, but I want to focus on other topics now. But this basically shows you that this would be the kind of the weakest signal-to-noise spectrum we would get in either of these cases, and we actually have very high-quality spectrum. Now,
you're assuming either
So we are actually assuming the lower metaverse here because I kind of never was very optimistic about metaverse. So we are assuming the lower metaverse. We do assume different dependencies with stellar spectral type. And so that's a very important question. What I will mention here, and we can chat more about this, is that this telescope that I will be describing, observatory, is scalable. So if somehow ETHERS turns out to be much lower than what we assume, we have capabilities to increase at some cost, but increase the capabilities. Okay, so the catch here is that you get this spectra if you have a 50-meter telescope in space, which is ridiculous, right? But I want to show you that we actually can get this capability, at least in large part. So to understand what we are doing, let me ask the question, why can't we build now a 50-meter space telescope, right? If you think back, Hubble 1990 was launched 1990, it's really a 1970s technology. How much almost everything in our life has changed in 1970 until today, right? But telescopes didn't change that much. Telescopes take a long time to build, and they evolve, but they evolve in a longer time. The key thing here is what people often call the space spiral. It's expensive to go to orbit, so missions are going to be expensive. So because they are expensive, we build only a low number of missions. We cannot build too many. So because we get only one infrared, one X-ray, etc. telescopes, we want them to be unique, and we want them to do everything in the infrared, everything in the UV, everything in the X-ray, because we only get one chance in every ticket. So we end up in this spiral with complex missions with essentially no tolerance for failure. Right? And this spiral goes on. It makes the missions more expensive, and the only way this spiral can extend, because of, we have a budget cap, is in time. So now it doesn't take any more 10 years, it takes 20, 30, maybe 40 years to build the next biggest mission because we are trapped in this spiral. What I think is exciting is that now we have an opportunity. In fact, we need to rethink whether we want to be in this spiral. Before we didn't have a choice, but now we do. So not everybody's trapped in the space spiral. The commercial aerospace already moved out. One example, maybe the most notorious example, is Starlink. Starlink is a telecommunications satellite network launched by SpaceX. They are launching, their plan is to launch 15,000 satellites. These 15,000 satellites are replacing a small number of very expensive multi-billion dollar communication satellites that we use basically as a backbone of our communications for the past many, many decades. These provide cost-effective, highly resilient, constellations that replace basically this single giant prototypes that were concentrating well for this. So could we adopt this approach? What stops us from adopting this approach? So the launch costs already dropped by a factor of 10, and it is possible that in the next few weeks we may see a launch from SpaceX. It's possible that SpaceX goes bankrupt, but I think the process will not stop. It was demonstrated that basically this technology is possible and it works. So launch was dropped, so the entry point to the spiral is weaker. We have no options, but we are still not using the economy of scale. We are still building a single prototype that's highly expensive, highly complex, concentrates all the risks that we have. So when we looked at with the group I formed 7 years ago, what stops us from actually using the economy of scale, what stops us from doing this more efficiently, we went through different systems, but we found that basically really the limitations that we cannot really build cost-effectively large mirrors. We can replicate any other component of a telescope or an instrument now pretty cost-effectively. For example, the SpaceX, the Starlink satellite I showed, every single one of them has a telescope system for a laser receiver and transmitter system. So and we build now CubeSats and small sets that are little observatories, and their key limitations, they cannot connect. So we came onto this as basically the challenge of large mirrors. How do you provide scalable capabilities to collect large amounts of light in a way that is low cost? And for the sake of time, I will just skip this. This figure just simply shows the evolution of telescopes, the largest telescopes. The key lessons I wanted to point out here, and I will just not go into details, is that throughout history, probably people who built telescopes, they always thought that they know how to do it the best ways. And there is often progress, but then you always plateau because your current technology reaches the plateau. But people work here, we probably believe that we are still doing the best possible way, but it's just very expensive to do this. But from time and time again in history, we found better ways to do much more capable telescopes at lower cost. This was done many times. Just when we are at the plateau, we kind of forget. Let me just leave it here. We can return to this, but that was the key lesson I wanted to do. So we need to be kind of open to other ideas, see paradigm changes. They're not always possible, but when they are, they can really transform what we can do. This is obviously kind of, again, hints on this that we need to look for breakpoints. So what we identify is a need to find a new option to replace primary mirrors in telescopes with lower, that basically enable lower cost telescopes benefiting from the economy of scale. If we can do that, then we basically can really open up astrophysics much more than transition from by a factor of two potentially in telescopes. So it turns out, as always, when you think that you have a great idea, you go back, somebody thought about this already. So in fact, it turns out from the defense side, there were two projects that were pursuing this idea. One of them is the IGLAS project. This is a defense project that's, to my knowledge, is not active anymore, but its goal was to create a 100-meter diameter telescope that's not looking for exoplanets, but monitoring Earth, obviously from a defense standpoint. This is a 5-meter demonstrator built on a diffractive, single-order diffractive lens. Okay? And This one is a newer project called Moiré. This was a DARPA-Ball Aerospace joint venture with the goal to demonstrate the technology that enables you to launch and deploy low-cost but very powerful, in this case, a 25-meter diameter space telescope to provide there's some really fascinating geopolitical aspects of why this is important, but I'm happy to chat about that. But so these are all Earth-looking, and the goal is to provide basically high-resolution images and wavelengths. Now, these things have three problems that make them not very well suited for astronomy. One of them is that they have very long focal lengths. So you end up with really awkward space telescopes where your primary lens may be 100 meters from your detector, which is just not very practical. The second is that because they use diffraction rather than refraction, they actually have pretty strong chromatic aberration. Not a problem if your goal is to identify cars or missiles moving around on the ground, but it is a problem for us because we want broad wavelengths. So that's problem number two. The third one is just some practical implementations here. This was actually a lithographically produced membrane. You can stretch the membrane and it gives you 1 meter diameter lens that's diffraction limited in a monochromatic wavelength range, and you can mass produce this. Pretty exciting. So we set out basically, I should mention that, parallel with our project. Again, I learned later, 3 years into the project, that Canon and Nikon has transitioned already some of this new technology. So if you may recall in the past when we watched a soccer match, you may see photographers, photojournalists with lenses this long, and sometimes handled by two people, right? Turning, and you don't see that anymore. Most of the lenses became much smaller, much more compact, much more lightweight. And that is because they combine conventional lens groups with diffractive optical elements. So these basically diffractive lenses, I mean, they have different names, they have different implementations, but the idea is that here the focusing is done by diffraction rather than refraction. Because it has an opposite sign, chromatic aberration as a refraction, it allows lens designers to create a very high quality system, balancing these out, high image quality, lightweight, much more compact and simpler. So this is quite successful commercially. So we have worked with, and when basically I asked around, okay, I had this idea, and I secretly asked a couple of people I knew who could be the best person in the world to work with in terms of diffractive optics. It was pointed out that the person works next door in the optical sciences building in University of Arizona, Tom Milster. So I teamed up with him. He spent his entire career designing diffractive lenses for microscopes. And he was happy to take on the challenge to design now instead of microscopes telescopes. So we published a paper in 2019 that provides much more details about the system. So I will just go a little bit faster here. We developed and invented and patented a new system called MOLT technology. It's multi-order diffractive engineered material optical elements. And in a sense, what this does, this is a little animation that shows that the advantage, and then I will speak about how it works. Imagine a conventional lens that will image a source into a screen. You can get an image. We are all familiar with this, but this lens is big and thick. So we could remove plane parallel chunks, and we would get basically a Fresnel lens with a simplistic surface, and we would basically get an imperfect image. What we are doing instead is we refine the front surface, we added a diffractive surface in the back, and we get a greatly improved image. Why is it greatly improved? We have basically an optical element, it's a single optical element, but it's like three lenses in one, because we have a diffractive lens in the front, diffractive lens in the back, and a little bit of residue or refraction. So another key point, why is this good? So it works, so that's already exciting, but it's very good because there's a fundamental scaling difference compared to conventional lens. In a conventional lens, if I go back here, if I scale this up by a factor of 10 in diameter, it will scale the same way in every dimension, right? It will be 10 times thicker, it will have 1,000 times larger volume, 1,000 times larger mass. That's why we are not using lenses anymore. But if I go with this lens, where the focusing is done by the surface, then the thickness doesn't have to change when I scale it up. So I can create a very large and very thin lens. And this is not exactly our technology, this is a simpler one. I will not create force, but let me pass this around. This is a commercial Freina lens. This kind of gives you the idea. What we are creating is from glass and a much higher quality, but this kind of gives you the idea. So
is it like two Freina lenses stuck?
So it's not quite Freina. So Freina lenses typically are single order, and we basically use optical freeform fabrication to craft the entire surface. So it is not, for a Freina lens, you typically have a constant gradient. We have basically every single part is designed and custom designed, optimized with this on a supercomputer across the entire surface, and we make single order. So maybe the backbone would be the back surface with a single order diffractive lens that's the closest to Freina lens, but we use also multi-order, multi-wave lens jobs. And so it works on in the simulation. This is a simulation that just shows that if you get within the circle, then you are very good. This is within the area. Get most of the intensity there. It's very high image quality. And when we start to leak some of the PSF, even in the early ones, it was 15 arc minutes away. So that's actually a pretty large field. And we got much better than this. We actually didn't just do simulations. We built the first prototype. We tested it in the lab, and we got diffraction limited resolution. And then we tested it at the soft quality field at the University of Arizona, and we got, again, diffraction limited resolution. So it does work at an intermediate band. Patented it. So this is our first prototype. We were very proud of it, even though it was a little bit thick. You can see here, for example, not with this illumination. I worked on the image I chose. Maybe you can. So in the front, you can see a multi-wavelength jumps, and in the back, it looks like we scratched the lens, but that's actually single order diffractive. It's like a grating, in a sense, similar to that. Okay, so we got better. The lens got thinner and better performance. We have now the largest such lens molded. I will get to that part in a moment. We completed this at the College of Optical Sciences. Let me pass this around. No, you cannot open it. You can see basically in the right illuminations, you have to illuminate in a specific way, but you can see the single order diffractive pattern in the back surface and the multi order diffractive pattern in the back. So it's works quite well. We are very excited about this because it really basically verifies the fabrication goals. What is a really important thing about this technology is not just thin and light, but that we can basically mass produce this, okay? So my lenses, for example, or anybody has eyeglasses, these are not done in workshops where people grind and polish for years. They are done in factories where lenses are mass produced in glass molding, thousands of lenses every day, right? And that's basically the kind of technology we are using. We use diamond tips to shape a surface, metal surface, and then we can, in a mold, we can quickly mold in a single step a lens like that. So this is became quite serious. We have a team of 15 people working on this. In the last SPIE in August, we had two sessions, a double session, with 8 talks dedicated to all aspects of this, from scattered light modeling to fabrication, operations, color correction, alignment systems, anything that we identify as a key point, we are working on it, and we made very good progress, and there are no showstoppers. We published our results too, so it's not just SPIA papers, but refereed papers, that in the optical design community and optical fabrication, they became actually quite popular, so we had multiple papers that were editors' picks, or most downloaded papers in leading optical journals for several months. Okay, but let's go back to space telescopes and finding life. What are the key advantages here? So this technology can provide optical elements that have roughly 100 times lower weight than conventional mirrors for the same diameter. So that's a big plus when you speak about space. What is more important is that they are much less sensitive to misalignments. Much of the cost of James Webb is arranging and keeping everything in alignment through a fabrication, testing, launch, and operation. And if James Webb wouldn't need to be aligned that well, by, say, a factor of 1,000, it would cost much less. And that's basically what our system is able to do. Plus, we don't have to spend years grinding, polishing, recoating, re-grinding, polishing segments. We can replicate them if we manage to scale up the technology, demonstrate that. we can replicate them quickly. We can, I will skip this, but there are also other advantages. You could even include additional diffractive elements to complicate the design. But how do we make a telescope out of this? So I mentioned that for the simulations I showed you, we needed a 50-meter telescope. But we don't actually need one 50-meter telescope. What we need is the light collecting power equivalent to that 50-meter telescope. Because for transits, we basically just measure intensities as a function of time and wavelengths, and we can combine that digitally. And we do that all the time. So Hubble does this and James Webb, they measure many transits to combine build of the same. So we need the equivalent for that. So let me show our vision. Let me show you our vision of what telescope we would like to make. So we plan to launch with a SpaceX Starship, or it could be an SLS Block 2. And this is a giant rocket. This is an astronaut for scale, but yes, not only that. And we'll launch the telescopes. We are not actually launching one, but we are planning to launch a total of 35 telescopes with two launches. To make this possible, we launch the telescopes in a compact configuration and then deploy them once in orbit. Each of these, these are the lenses in front. These are 8.5 meter diameter. Okay? Each of these is larger than James Webb and Hubble and Ariel in terms of light collecting power together, and we plan to launch 35. It will be very dramatic. So they, as you see, they deploy. So key things here. It is not formation flying, it is not an interferometer, just parallel observing telescope that could be spatially anywhere. So it's not an interferometer. So each of these, you see the blue bag here that provides solar power. There's, while it looks pretty radical, the only component that we don't have currently today, technology, is the lens. So that's what we are working on. Everything else basically taken from projects that exist in space heritage. What is pretty cool here is that we would have 35 telescopes, each of which larger sensitivity than James Webb and Hubble combined, that could all do independent science projects. This could be looking for near-Earth objects, this could be studying high-redshift galaxies, this could be looking for AGMs, but when you need them, they could all turn to the same target and provide a combined light collecting power, equivalent to a 50 meter diameter space telescope. So this is basically what would enable us to collect enough light to survey 1,000 planets for atmospheric biosignatures and other standard diodes. You have seen inflation. The inflation part is pretty cool when it comes up. It is not a mission critical part. We could replace them just with motors, but we looked for the simplest way to deploy large element, and it turns out actually inflatable are they exist. One of the earliest NASA satellites, technically the first one, was a large inflatable radar reflector. There's another cool project at the University of Arizona that does inflatable space antennas. So the International Space Station, I don't know if you know, it has an inflatable human spaceflight rated module. So inflatables are attributed. This is the cross-section, and I will skip this, but I would just point out again that we have a compact configuration for the launch. And we try to keep everything simple, because we have to fit in the cost. So again, a single Nautilus unit will have a larger light collecting area than James Webb, HST and Ariel are combined. And of course, that's amazing on its own, but we plan not to build one, but we hope to build 35 of these. And we have done, I mean, this is a pretty, I'm very excited about this idea. This, we were featured in Sky and Telescope as one of the projects for the future of astronomy. But it is more than just a fancy idea. You have seen that we are building prototypes. We have multiple systems. So I'm not going, I don't have time to go through all of these, but we have basically, we are working, we have a mission concept paper. We have a multitude of papers on the science, because that's really what drives this. By now, probably we are close to maybe 15 SPIA papers on different aspects. We submitted a white paper to the Astro 2020 presentation. We have multiple generations of these lenses developed, also an alignment system, optical test bench system, extensive simulations that we are verifying. We have developed different ways to estimate cost. That's always a a challenging aspect for any large space project. We have top-down and bottom-up component level and scaling-based cost estimates. And they suggest that there is a large part of the parameter space within which we are consistent with the flagship project. So we have multiple invention disclosures. This is a technology that is also probably transferable. So we are looking potentially at virtual reality headsets, where you also benefit from lighter and lenses, et cetera, military drones, and other uses. But our goal is with the science. We have a telescope that we build custom design for this. And in, hopefully in the next weeks, maybe 2 months, we will have hopefully completed our on-sky tests with the new larger lens. Some of the next steps, we are basically completing these tests that should be March 2023 for the 24-centimeter lens. We were invited by the Moore Foundation to submit a proposal to build the largest, world's largest molding machine at the University of Arizona. So hopefully we complete that, and then with that we will be able to create one meter or in different configuration, 1.6 meter lenses in about 3 years. So I think that already would be revolutionary for medium plus missions. We are also pursuing higher technology readiness levels through thermal vacuum tests, vibration tests will follow, and we are looking at flight opportunities through the NASA programs and separately for the stratospheric flight opportunities through a private event. Okay, and with that, I came to the end. This is the last slide. So what I wanted to tell you, and I hope I was able to show that, I think we are at a convergence point where we have revolutionary new launch capabilities coming up, both through SLS and then hopefully through Starship, and then coupled with new optical technology and really the emerging set of new science questions, we can rethink what we want to do and how we want to do it in terms of space telescopes. And I think at the University of Arizona, we're very excited about this new technology. We have made much progress thanks to the foundation of the Portland Betty Moore Foundation and the University of Arizona itself. So we are really looking forward to having something like this on the sky and have the capability to survey 1,000 birds, understand their diversity, and search for signatures of life. Thank you.
I'm sure we have some questions. Encourage them, especially from the graduate students, but would like to come up.
So what sort of spectral range?
Yes, so I left out, I have about another 120 slides. We are looking at from 0.3 to 1.7 micron as a baseline. We could do longer wavelength range, but basically it's keeping costs controlled. So it would be nice to go beyond 1.7, maybe go up to 2.5 for multiple good reasons, but it would require basically cooling systems that are more expensive. But it's not the technology, it's mostly the implementation and cost. That can be revisited. So we want to basically at once keeping the design very focused on the key science case, and then when we have everything, you know, closing, more higher tier level, etc., then ask the question, what else could we put in to enable even broader set of science questions?
The moment of inertia seems to be so you can rotate it very fast.
Yeah, so basically, so it kind of like the spherical design. I mean, there's of course something with a physicist and spherical pose. This makes sense for multiple reasons, thermal management and inflation, etc. In principle, this would have the capability to rotate relatively fast. It is probably not going to be a limiting factor, especially if you have many units. So we could slow earlier, but yes.
Yeah, so I'm asking because if we follow up, say a kilonova or something, then the reaction is critical. And it's kind of surrealistic that with AWST, we slew for hours or minutes of observation.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So we identified basically faint object studies, high redshift studies, some of the solar system time domain, etc., as other science cases that could be pursued. We didn't look at, you know, operational planning, and that's a good point. I will think a bit more about that. It certainly we could. This is in terms of the concept maturity level, it's a relatively low maturity concept. We don't have a complete design. We looked at all the potential bottlenecks and showstoppers, and then we identified 2 to 3 viable solutions for them. But we need to advance the TRL before it makes sense to do a system level design and optimize and trade studies.
I'm curious how you settled on 50 meters as the diameter. Why not 100 meters, 25?
I would love 100 meters anymore. So basically the it is all derived from the science goal. So what we said is that our goal is to have 1,000 exoers that are, and what we need there, because we can only study birds that are transiting. So we need to consider, and we did a simulation, what is the stellar density for different spectral type stars? What is the occurrence rate of planets of the right size in the habitable zone? So as a function of spectral type, how far do I need to go to be able to collect 1,000 exoers that are transiting? And then for each spectral type, given the habitable zone planet, we will transit at a given cadence. Earth transits only one time every 365 days. So that's only during that 8 or 10 hours when you can collect your life. So we said the mission lifetime should be 10 years. It could be longer, but the core mission, primary mission, 10 years. So we need to fit in enough transits in that 10 years to get to the right enough signal to noise for that many planets. And then the variable was the life collecting power. And that's how we ended up with it, very close to 50 million.
What sits the baseline distance between different elements of your constellation? What is the maximum or minimum that can go without any compromise on the science?
That's a good point. So basically, this one is we don't want to, but we would love to make this an interferometer where you combine phase correctly information. But right now, this is an incoherent array, which is much easier to work with. So right now, the actual distances don't matter really, as long as you can observe the same source. So we basically just digitally collect the information and digitally combine them later. So the relative locations, relative orientations don't really matter. If it were an interferometer, it would be a very big deal, but it would be a cost multiplier, and that's just, currently not.
Why would that be a cost multiplier?
Yeah, so it doesn't seem like a complex problem, but it is a complex problem to fly spacecrafts, basically. With the metrology, it's part of metrology and then delay line problems to basically combine the light. For the interferometer, right, you basically need to control the optical path differences to within a fraction of the wavelengths of the light. And the spacecraft obviously move around in space, and so you would need to rotate, etc. So you would need to keep the spacecraft position, and within the spacecraft, the optical elements, the entire optical path, aligned to within a fraction of a wavelength over large distances. So it's not that it's impossible, but it's very expensive, and if you combine it with very large apertures, it just doesn't seem compatible with the current cost curve. But if you could do it, it would give you amazing spatial resolution. So I think the
So with this much collecting area, you get those biosignatures you were looking at with a single transit, or do you still need to stack multiple transits?
So you basically had a very good question too. So basically, you would have 1,000 targets, right? And then basically they are roughly equally distributed in a given volume, unit volume. So you would have many more of the targets far away than close, just because of the volume goes with the asteroid. So for the majority of the targets, you would need to observe many transits, basically pretty much collect all the transits or most of the transits during the mission. Those that are, and you would have the, they are basically good enough, but not the highest signal to noise. And then the targets that are close to us, you would have basically a huge boost from being 10 times, 100 times closer. So you would get probably one transit, you would get enough signal. And then you could ask other science questions. You could maybe try to get a higher spectral resolution. You could look at temporal variability. You could explore other smaller planets.
Okay.
So going back to Naaman's question, I sort of had the same question. I'm just listening to your answer. I'm wondering, is it really a technological problem or is it a signal processing and computational problem? I'm wondering that. Because that seems cheap.
Yeah. So I think it would depend on how you do your interferometry, if you are thinking about the interferometry, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you have basically an ability to detect the phases of the incoming photons, like the Event Horizon Telescope does, then it's a computational problem. But if you don't have the photon information, then I think it would be primarily, you would need to rely on matching the optical baseline mechanically. And then it is, I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that that you have both a challenge with the metrology, so you need to control the metrology basically to a fraction of the wavelength of light, and then also to actually, once you detected a difference, to act on it and then correct. And I think you just have many degrees of freedom and moving around with a fraction of the wavelength of light. So I think we would all love to see, and there will be hopefully space interferometers. I know that the Astro 2020 Decadal Survey looked at a two-element far-infrared interferometer, and to my surprise, they concluded that it's not compatible with a $5 to $7 billion cost cap. And I'm really interested to find out what was the cost driver there, and I don't, maybe some of you know this.
Yeah, I mean, even if you measure the full electric field at each telescope, you still need to know the positions of the telescopes relative to each other to probably more than picometers. So that is a huge engineering problem, even if you just record the electric field.
Yeah, the methodological. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do you want to put this?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's we have two potential orbits identified. It could be a Sonner's L2. But another possibility could be in a Tess-like orbit. So Tess is in a really funny lunar synchronous, highly elliptic, highly eccentric orbit that brings it close to Earth every lunar month. So you spend basically about 25 days roughly far away from the Earth, and then you come closer for a brief period of time. That orbit is interesting because Tess has shown that it's achievable. It requires a smaller delta V, and it provides the thermal stability that we would need, so it would be maybe easier to get to. But at the moment, we keep both on the most often.
Two last questions.
Are there other applications you thought of for these lenses, and are the lenses of the same design as your colleague who was in the microscope on the market?
So, very good question. So, for the first one, we think that this could be suitable for a broad range of applications. We are not really pursuing them. We submitted to the Air Force a white paper pointing out that this could be very good for military drones, where a lighter lens would enable you a longer flight time, so longer reach, but it's not my interest to build military drones. So, that's definitely one direction. We consider ground-based telescopes too. The advantages are less obvious, but potentially significant. There may be commercial applications too. I mean, it came up to create virtual reality lenses that are much lighter, etc. But it's again, one of our students actually was interning on with Meta designing their diffractive lenses. So I think there are other applications, but the biggest, the biggest payoff is in space. That's basically where it would be the biggest impact. The second question was, whether these are the same lenses. No, they are not the same lenses. So these are basically, it's a new invention. It's a custom developed just for this purpose.
Related to the previous question, actually, could this lens technology be adapted for shorter wavelengths?
So we did get requests also for going both for longer wavelengths and shorter wavelengths. And the longer wavelengths you go, the easier it becomes to design them because your wavelength is bigger, so everything is easy. If you go the shorter wavelengths, it's still doable. Our technology is actually the specs that we can get from our technology already, they exceed what we need. So we could actually push this to shorter wavelength. What you do need to do, though, is to change the material that you are using, because you need the material to be transmissive. And in the going to the medium infrared is not difficult. Nothing is easy, but it would be doable. Going to the UV becomes increasingly challenging because of the optical throughputs. It's probably possible. We are not doing that at the moment. In principle, the lens design itself could work and the fabrication could work. The key is to find the right material.
Well, we can continue our conversations over dinner. Let's just thank Danny one more time for the effort.
For dinner, those of you who signed up, it's all set up very elegantly over here. There's white wine, beer, and juice, soda and water in the refrigerator. And the food will be here in about 5 minutes. So don't go away.
Thank you. Excellent.
Yes. Oh, yes.